Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. This is part two of our two-part series with Dr. Antonia Repeled, discussing how stress directly influences gut health and inflammation in spondyloarthritis. She explains physiological connections between stress, the gut-brain axis, and immune responses, highlighting how stress can intensify GI and joint symptoms. In our last episode, we left off with the most beautiful sentiment, which was build a life that supports your body and your well-being. I love that. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
So we didn't get to somatic work, and I want to open with that before we get into, well, I think that probably leads a little bit into the physiology when we're experiencing chronic stress. But can you talk a little bit about somatic work? Because I think that is like, could be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many different types of somatic psychotherapies, of course, but some of the main modalities that I utilize are things like mindfulness practices and breath work. And clinical hypnosis certainly has a big somatic component as well, which I love to talk about because it's often super, super effective in a very short amount of time, which who doesn't love that, especially when you're dealing with chronic health conditions like spondyloarthritis. So yeah, I would love to maybe talk a little bit more about maybe what some of that looks like.
Yeah, for sure. So tell us first, though, what is... I think, and again, I'm going to lean on Instagram here for poisoning this for all of us, but like,
yeah.
We see a lot about somatic yoga and how you can lose 22 pounds in 14 days. And
oh gosh.
I'm sort of pointing a finger at that not being real, but yeah. I think somatic is sort of a timely, like it's trendy right now, but yeah. I think it's rooted in like really good approaches that are natural.
Yep, definitely. Yeah. And you're right. It's definitely, you know, it's definitely trendy. Essentially, somatic is just a fancy way, I think, of just saying that we're going to learn a little bit more about what our bodies are telling us and what messages they're sending. So, you know, with things like clinical hypnosis, really, really powerful tool in my practice, especially for patients that have either gut issues and or chronic pain from things like arthritis. So with that somatic piece, so as one example, I might guide a patient through a personalized visualization that uses something called a hypnotic anchor, which can be a gesture, it can be a memory, it could be an image. So let's say we're using a gesture as our anchor, like placing our hand on over our heart. While imagining that as we're doing that, there's warmth and healing that's just being sent through that hand and into the heart and through the rest of the body, or let's say through the joints in our hips or our wrists or, you know, our ankles, wherever that inflammation is. And that will help that individual decrease those pain signals in the body, and also shifting the brain's focus away from that threat of that pain and towards safety. And so that is something that we might integrate into a clinical hypnosis script, and something that will help a patient then utilize outside of those live sessions of hypnosis through something that we call self-hypnosis, where they'll start to actually learn how to use that anchor in real time when they are experiencing distress, whether it's emotionally, physically, or both. And over time, the more that they use that anchor, it's that conditioned response, the more that they're actually going to get that relief that they're looking for in the body. And essentially what that looks like in terms of self-hypnosis is really just like a very short, simple, focused relaxation technique where we're just guiding ourselves into that calm and alert state so our mind and our bodies can feel better. So as opposed to me guiding that patient in a session, I'm teaching them how to essentially take pieces of that and use that on their own time through use of an anchor, like putting the hand, using that gesture of placing the hand over the heart.
That's awesome. Do you have a favorite story of a patient that came back after you did it that gave you feedback on what happened?
Oh yeah, I have a bunch. Well, say one of the, it's really hard to choose. So one of the, I think the coolest, I should say, by the way that I think it's cool, one of the coolest experiences that I had was with a young patient who had really, really, really debilitating nausea. And it was so debilitating that it would cause just like intense pain in the abdominal muscles, so much so that like over time, what was happening was that essentially the intense nausea was causing the abdominal muscles to tense up, right? And that's what then started causing the pain. But then over time, over and over again, with that chronic nausea presenting itself so frequently, even just like the slightest tinge of what the patient might have interpreted as nausea, even if it wasn't actual nausea, was just automatically causing that conditioned response of the abdominal muscles to tense up, therefore causing the pain in the abdominal wall and muscles and intensifying that nausea or then bringing about that nausea. So we had to unlearn that conditioned response by implementing a new one. And so what we determined was that what would be best as an anchor for them, and you know, we tend to make things really fun and imaginative for kids, but certainly for adults too, but this was a pediatric patient, was that anytime they, one of their safe foods or beverages, I should say, was 7-Up, that was something that didn't take that intense nausea away, but at least it took the edge off. So I decided to suggest, hey, maybe we should use our imagination and imagine drinking 7-Up when you're having all this nausea that's leading to this abdominal pain. So we created our anchor surrounding imagining drinking that 7-Up anytime that nausea came up. And we also, like most things in therapy, we don't want to just wait until we feel really sick or unwell to use those coping skills. We want to practice them outside of those moments too, so our bodies have more familiarity with them and it's easier for us to use it in those moments of distress. So in and out of those distressing moments, I was guiding that patient in live sessions of hypnosis to imagine what it would feel like when they're having that nausea, that then they're taking that sip of their refreshing drink, and as it's going down the throat, it's coating the throat and the entire belly and all of those abdominal muscles, really the entire GI tract. And with this healthy coating, almost like medication, and it's just eliminating or evaporating all that nausea and pain. And then I taught them how to utilize that in self-hypnosis, where they would take a couple deep breaths, close their eyes, and imagine that they were drinking that 7-Up, putting their hand on that bottle, putting that bottle to their mouth. And as they were drinking it, they would then imagine all of that healthy change happening for them. And their nausea went away. And when it did come up in the future, as it sometimes would, they could mitigate it and stop it in its tracks really quickly. So that was really, really cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that. That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So should we get into like, what is that? What actually happens to your body when you're experiencing chronic stress? Like physiologically, yeah. What goes on? Because I think this brings a lot of the gut and the joint together, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So anytime we're experiencing that chronic stress, our autonomic nervous system, more so the sympathetic branch, our autonomic nervous system is made up of the sympathetic and parasympathetic. So that sympathetic branch, that's like our fight or flight. And the parasympathetic, as I mentioned, I think in the last episode, is our rest and digest. So what happens with that chronic stress to that sympathetic branch is that the chronic stress ends up continuously activating that sympathetic or that fight or flight system. And so then we're experiencing, physiologically speaking, elevated levels of cortisol and adrenaline and pro-inflammatory markers. So over time, what is happening then is that prolonged stress and activation can do things like increase our pain sensitivity and cause, you know, more discomfort that then that's already just present alone from that arthritis. And let's say we're talking about GI specific things, we can actually, we've seen in research that it can actually suppress our digestion as well. And in both of these conditions, we're just experiencing dysregulation in the immune system, right, which can lead to flares. So essentially, our bodies are staying in like a constant state of alert, which of course, as you can imagine, is going to then wear down not only our physically, but also, you know, emotionally as well. And so when we can help that individual with things like somatic techniques or mind-body therapies, tap into that parasympathetic branch, that rest and digest branch, we can then help them recover and regulate and manage that chronic stress, and essentially learn how to tap into that calming mode more easily and quickly. So that way we can create more of that regulation between that gut-brain access again and stop that dysregulation.
So can I ask what might not be a linked question?
Yeah,
I've been reading The Molecule of More. Have you read this book? It's a dopamine.
I have not, but I've heard of it. Yeah.
And the one thing I learned that was so strange, and it talks about, right, your neurotransmitters and dopamine sort of being associated with fight or flight at times. I'm not a neuroscientist, so I don't want to screw this up. But one of the most interesting things that I learned there was when you have dopamine activated in your brain, it like can go to one of two different places. Mm-hmm. And one of them sort of doesn't make you impulsive. It makes you like be able to make it through the whole problem all the way to the here and now. And is cortisol that way? Like cortisol at times is good, right? It can be good for you, but is there a place where does it path through two different places in your brain and your gut? Because I know, right, like most of your neurotransmitters they're finding now even like are produced in the gut, or many of them. But is cortisol like that? Like, are we trying to, we're not trying to eliminate getting cortisol, but we're trying to eliminate it like improperly or reduce it improperly, like bursting into our systems?
Essentially. Because so I think what you're saying, so what we know is that like most things, like it's not inherently good or bad, right? It depends. We know that stress can lower dopamine. And then what happens with lower dopamine, it's going to worsen mood and pain regulation, right? And then that poor regulation can increase inflammation and flares. And then what happens with flares, it leads to stress and pain, right? So it perpetuates that cycle. With cortisol, it's not that different. We know just in and of itself, cortisol is the body's primary stress hormone, and it's produced by our adrenal glands. And because of that, it helps us regulate inflammation, metabolism, blood sugar, sleep, wake cycle, all these other things. But you know, when we're talking about arthritis, like the main focus is that inflammation first and foremost. So in response to stress, what happens is our brain is going to activate in a way that then is going to release unnecessary amounts of cortisol. Short-term cortisol, a short-term increase can be protective and almost like reduce inflammation and kind of like boost energy, so to speak. But the chronic component of that chronic stress and therefore like an overwhelming release of cortisol or just over time releasing too much cortisol from that increased stress or chronic stress will then actually cause a dysregulation of cortisol, understandably, because there's too much to regulate. And that can harm the body. Just like too little cortisol can cause, you know, difficulties in terms of like metabolism and other things. So essentially, like when we're talking about things like, arthritis, and even things like, you know, GI issues and even beyond like lupus, early on in flares, cortisol can actually, we've seen from research, can actually help us with a reduction in inflammation. But then over time, what happens is with that chronic stress, especially if we have longer flares, Again, it's going to cause that chronic dysregulation because we don't really know what to do with it. And then what happens is that it impairs that anti-inflammatory effect that we need. And so when we have autoimmune arthritis or things that are also, you know, other autoimmune diseases, excuse me, like lupus or like IBD, the body is going to become less sensitive to that cortisol. And it's going to then lead to more inflammatory activity. So it's confusing in the sense that there's a lot going on in a lot of different directions, but essentially cortisol and dopamine can affect each other in that feedback loop positively or negatively, but that negative, that dysregulation of one is going to then disrupt the other. So if we look at it from like a more like, if I'm gonna bullet point all of that for listeners, like stress is going to lead to the cortisol spikes, and then the chronic stress is going to lead to that cortisol dysregulation. And then the cortisol is going to then lose that anti-inflammatory power. Inflammation is going to increase. Arthritis flares going to increase and worsen. And then what else follows? All the other stuff that we hate, pain and the fatigue and more stress. And then that cycle continues.
You just described my 40s. No.
I just described most of my life. So I
no, I know. Like this is, it's crazy. Yeah. Okay, well, let's maybe talk about fixing it and what the research says, and then like gut, like I want to back up because I know we've been talking more general, but like this gut thing is fascinating, and the story you told about the Sprite or the 7-Up, sorry, maybe we should be getting sponsorship dollars from sodas. Just kidding. It's fascinating though when you think about how. In that case, like in yoga, we call it like turning toward your body, like turning toward yourself. And that can help to reduce some of those things. But in general, like across the gut and the joints, is it similar processes that are creating the pain or the discomfort?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, because we know that stress directly impacts that gut-brain axis, because how could it not? Because that communication network between the brain, gut, and our immune system is so closely connected. So in things like, you know, autoimmune arthritis, or let's say IBD, specifically Crohn's, which very frequently causes joint symptoms. In either of those situations where inflammation then affects both the gut and the joints, stress is going to act like fuel on fire in both conditions, by disrupting that gut function, triggering those immune responses, and then making that pain and discomfort feel more intense. So if we don't address stress, if we're only addressing things from the, like a traditional like medical framework, let's say, we are missing a huge piece of the treatment puzzle. And I know I'm biased because I'm a mental health professional, but I'm also a patient. And I'm telling you, we're going to miss it. You're just doing yourself a disservice, especially during flares. You know, we can't necessarily stop flares in their tracks or else we'd all be doing it all the time, but we can certainly make them so much less stressful and so much less uncomfortable and distressing. So
Yeah, listen, your bias is okay with with me. it supports, and I'm gonna do a pitch here, like it supports the need for more research on these things for people with these diseases.
Yeah.
Period. Absolutely. Because I think there's even like very limited research. Mm-hmm. Peer-reviewed research on the link between like IBS, IBD, and SPA, which is, you know it, I know, like,
yeah,
it's there's a huge link. Okay, so we got off topic a bit. I apologize.
No,
I told you we go in the weeds sometimes. So going back to how to reduce the stress and like the body's response to this to get ourselves feeling better. Like what are the, I guess it's two questions. What are the bigger barriers that patients with SPA or gut issues have to resolving these problems?
So many things. I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to things like spot. I mean, the stress, just like I mentioned with those physical symptoms, it isn't just in your head, you know, even though we know everything's starting there. It's turning up that volume on the inflammation in our body. And if you already have an autoimmune condition, you know, like spa, stress is going to make your joints feel worse. And then it's possibly even going to disrupt the balance in your gut, which can then even trigger more painful or other immune system problems. And that is often why we see these conditions like spa, IBS, IBD co-occurring. We even know that there actually is some growing evidence, which is great, of research showing that stress increases certain inflammatory markers, like things like IL-6 and CRP. I'm not going to get off like on a huge tangent here and nerd out completely, but essentially these are like two chemicals that we know are linked to stress and immune activity. So we've seen from some growing research that stress is increasing some of those inflammatory markers specifically, and therefore actually reducing gut motility and microbial diversity. So with things like spa, that combination we know is definitely leading to symptom flares. And we also know that it's changing how our nervous systems are processing that pain. So that means that stress can make already inflamed areas in your body very much feel more painful or sensitive. I know I'm like repeating myself in different ways throughout, but like, I really like to get that message across.
So yeah, that's so
that it's not, it is, yeah, it is scientific. It's, we're seeing it in science. It's not, you're not making this up in your head by any means. So that's why we know that stress can trigger autoimmune flares. Many patients have shared with me, and I know this myself too, that they knew that a flare was coming after certain periods of stress. So like travel, like really significant loss, family tension, work overload, let's say. But I also want to emphasize, stress doesn't cause spa, stress doesn't cause IBD, right? And patients, you're not doing anything wrong when a flare happens. It's not your fault. But we know that stress can obviously impact that immune function through that research, and gut permeability and how our nervous system is processing pain. So then our bodies are just more vulnerable to symptoms, and it makes then recovery more challenging. So I really like to emphasize that, because it really helps individuals then respond with that self-compassionate lens and respond better to these practical tools rather than engage in that blame and guilt. That, you know, doesn't need to be there. There's enough that we have going on already. So when we're talking about effective therapies for stress and chronic illness, integrative approaches, you know, are often most effective. So you know, usually I tell patients, like, I'm gonna give you like a heavy dose or cocktail of all the great stuff that we know works well. We're going to do condition specific CBT. We're going to do things like acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, and clinical hypnosis and other somatic psychotherapies to give you the most bang for your buck and give you a really, really nice full coping toolbox. So that way you can pick and choose whatever you'd like at the end of treatment, depending on how you feel. So we know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, condition-specific CBT helps us kind of identify and shift illness-related thought patterns that can worsen stress and symptoms. And then things like ACT, you know, acceptance and commitment therapy, that is almost like a cousin of CBT. It's another behavioral therapy, but instead of kind of focusing on shifting our thoughts, with ACT, we're thinking about supporting psychological flexibility and teaching individuals how to stay present. There's a big mindfulness component there, and take action based on values, even in the presence of discomfort. And that doesn't mean pushing ourselves too far. It just means learning more about our bodies and learning, you know, ways that we can still live in accordance with our values, despite what might be going on health-wise. So maybe if we do have a goal of doing some jumping jacks, we can.
Yeah. Well, okay. Should we do it? Should we try that?
Sure.
All right. Cause you hit me with the values word, right? I think a lot of how we unpack this, and I mean, like, probably like many people, I've been through CBT at times in my life. And I do remember there was a really tough time, and I looked at my therapist and I was like, Steve, I'm spinning. I don't even think I know what my values are right now. And it forced me to sit down and do like the little values exercise funnel.
Yeah.
I give it to like employees and people, and like whenever So yeah, we could totally do that around jumping if you want, if you've got a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, whatever would be helpful for you.
No, I think it's a really good one. The values piece. Because you're right. Like the link is, so my personal values are health, faith, family, kindness, and curiosity. Those are my, I think they're fine. I've been considering revisiting the funnel, but like I had to put health was never at the front my whole life until I went through spondylitis. Like I went through being not well for 20 years, coming through to feeling better. And then I realized that's at the front. That has to be at the front because I'm going to reread what you said. You have to build a life that supports your body and your well-being. Mm-hmm. And the jumping is a part of that. That's what's making me, maybe it is a values driven like reason.
Yeah.
So you would this be the kind of conversation you'd have?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would even take it a step further to even what I said before that, and again, I'm biased, but your mental health really is at the root of your physical health. So health has to be at the forefront. And oftentimes our mental health does, and I say this to my patients all the time, when we're going through a really, really distressing period, like a flare, to some extent, sometimes our mental health has to take a backseat, so to speak, because we have to obviously be able to manage what's going on physically, especially if we can't even, you know, hold a pencil, get out of bed, brush our teeth, et cetera, right? But what ends up happening is once we start to feel better, understandably, even though our physical symptoms might be improving, or maybe we're getting back in remission, hopefully, all the impact of that hasn't gone anywhere. So even though we might have been stressed, depressed, anxious during that heightened flare, when that physical kind of impact or our physical well-being had to take a little bit more of a front seat, now that mental health piece is still there kind of saying, hey, what about me? Like, and I'm even, in a lot of ways, you're even more distressed sometimes when you're feeling better because of that, right? Because your nervous system hasn't forgotten, your body's still holding on to it. So that's why I always like to point out that our mental health really is at the root of it all. If we're going to use that, if we're going to put on our ACT hats for a second here, and maybe connected to your health is movement, and maybe a specific type of movement that you'd like to engage in or re-engage in is jumping jacks, right? I would maybe say, okay, so what are some ways maybe that you are, I don't know, maybe are you willing to experience a little bit of discomfort or unpredictability without avoidance? Or have you been fully avoiding even getting close to doing a jumping jack lately? What does that look like?
I'm getting better at jumping jacks. It's the actual jumping. But yeah, I mean, I think I'm willing to experience some discomfort. Like I've started doing the classes again that like make you move like 1 foot up on the platform, down 1 foot up. I used to be totally avoidant to jumping. I did learn like 5 or 6 years ago, and then I've let it fall off and I've been like, no, I'm too old. No, I'm too this. I think so. I think maybe that, I think the, there was a word in your question, which was willing. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really, I hit that when you were like, are you willing? I was like, yeah. But I think this is, it's a lot of things, right? That willing probably comes into a lot of choices we make.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering too, it's like if we can maybe notice those urges that come up maybe in those classes, right? Or even when you're thinking about going to another class or maybe getting closer to doing something that resembles like a full-blown jumping jack or just jumping in and of itself, maybe you can start to notice what those urges really feel like in that moment to resist that pain or discomfort, right? What that avoidance looks like. There's even some things that individuals are engaging in that they didn't even recognize before. Maybe it's even just avoiding the thought because that's uncomfortable, right? And so that's a big part of it too, where sometimes we fall on the other end of the spectrum where we're not, we're actually engaging too much and we're becoming hypervigilant and checking constantly in with ourselves every second, let's say in that exercise class, to make sure we're not harming ourselves, even if we're not jumping at all, right? It's almost like, you know, if we can get a little bit more, if we can increase that mindfulness surrounding, you know, these experiences and those sensations in our body that are kind of telling us, those alarm systems that are going off and telling us, no, we can't do it. We can understand a little bit more about what that looks like. And then we can invite ourselves to kind of pay a little bit attention to maybe how we can separate ourselves or create a little bit more separation between ourselves, let's say, and that distressing thought that we, if we did, you know, do, let's say, a full-fledged jumping jack or start jumping up and down, that we would harm ourselves in some way. So that's a really big piece act that I love, is like creating a little bit of healthy space between ourselves and those distressing thoughts. We don't have to change them, right? That's the CBT piece. We don't have to avoid them either, and we don't have to engage with them even really in any unhealthy way where that hypervigilance might come in. But maybe we can just create a little bit of space between our thoughts. So sometimes I'll teach patients, and this is called cognitive diffusion, where we'll start to do these tiny little shifts. It doesn't even take a lot, but it's so powerful over time. So where, let's say if that thought is, I can't jump because I'm too old, right? We're going to shift from, okay, I'm noticing that I'm having that thought again that I can't jump because I'm too old. That little shift of just labeling it with that phrase of I'm having that thought again before we actually name that thought is one way that we're creating that space. And we're also acknowledging that even though that thought is uncomfortable and it's there, it's not based in fact, right? And there's nothing to point in the direction that it's actually based in any truth. It's distressing and we don't like it, but that's all it is, right? We could also say that thought out loud in a really silly voice. We can imagine that we're placing that thought on a cloud above us, and we're just going to wait until it passes by, and then we're going to go about our day and continue to do something else, right? So that's where that that space becomes a lot more large, essentially, over time. We can create more and more of that space. And we're also creating more present moment awareness too, which is what's really nice about ACT, where we're connecting back to the now, not these future or anticipatory fears or anxieties, and not what may have happened in the past, right? What's happening right now, and paying attention to how that feels in our body to be more present focused. And there's so many different ways we could even do that. But that's just like one little piece of that ACT puzzle. And then we can start to think about, well, how does this connect with my values? Like, if I really do want to get one step closer to maybe moving my body in that way, because it is something that is important to me in terms of a health-related value, what can I do? Maybe I don't have to even put a goal in place yet or even take those like stepped gradual behavioral activation kind of or behavioral pieces to this puzzle. Maybe at first I'm just going to explore what it feels like to think about imagining myself doing some jumping, right, without any limitations. And then I'm going to think about what it's like, what it might be like to imagine doing that jumping with limitations, right? So that's just one piece of that ACT puzzle that can be really important to, like, allowing ourselves to create that space between that distressing thought or thoughts, and then move more towards our values with that flexibility and curiosity, despite internal discomfort, in a flexible and committed way.
I love that. Okay. What did we miss? We took ourselves on a bit of a journey. Yes. What did we miss before we don't get to talk to you? Because I think this is so cool.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this, you know, my daughter is 17 and they had a GI psychologist come in recently into their health class.
Cool.
And she thought it was the coolest thing, which makes me think if the 17-year-old kids think it's cool, there is something connecting between
right.
all of this. mm-hmm. But what did we miss that listeners should know or maybe want to explore?
Yeah, I think maybe just some like practical stress reduction techniques too, because I know we talked about like these specific treatment modalities, but as we know, that might not always be accessible for everyone. So some practical things that we can do, you know, on our own to really help support our bodies and our brains. Diaphragmatic breathing is a big thing that I love for pain, for GI discomfort, even just for like emotion regulation. And it only has to take a few minutes, but it can really shift that nervous system out of that fight or flight mode. And there's like tons of videos out there online that you could always watch if you want to see it, you know, a little bit more clearly. But typically, really all we have to do is just find a comfortable position, whether we're sitting or lying down. And the goal of diaphragmatic breathing is to essentially not move this upper body. So I always guide patients, but as they're getting comfortable using this, with putting one hand on their heart, one hand over their belly. And as opposed to our traditional breathing, where as we're inhaling, we're kind of maybe tightening or sucking at the stomach muscles, and on the exhales, we're releasing, we're going to switch it up. So we're going to imagine almost at that as we're inhaling slowly, it's almost like we're blowing up a balloon. And so that hand on our belly is going to rise, even though I know you can't see that. And then we're going to hold that there for a few seconds if that feels good. And then we're going to slowly exhale out through our mouth or our nose. And then our belly is going to fall, with really trying not to move this hand up here at all. And that has been proven to really, really reduce stress responses in the body, calm down any discomfort and pain in the gut or elsewhere, and just reconnect us to whatever it is that we want to refocus on. I always tell patients, though, with the caveat is if, as we're getting comfortable using that type of breathing in the in those focused ways, especially if you're lying down, you want to just make sure you're slowly getting up, because sometimes it can make us a little dizzy if we're not being intentional. But otherwise, it's a great one to use and to get comfortable with. And oftentimes patients will say like, yeah, I'm doing these types of breathing exercises, but they're not working. And I always say, okay, first, how are you doing it? Let's see if there's some things that we need to tweak or maybe that we missed. And also, we can't always expect like that instant relief. I know that's what we all want, especially with living with things like spa. That practice and that intentional practice and coming back to that and slowing down is what's going to give us that relief over time. So even if it doesn't feel great in that moment, that's okay. Returning to that in ways that feel good is what's really most important. So that's just one easy thing we can do. You know, we can certainly, you know, I talked about butterfly tapping previously. That's a really easy technique that can really tap into that parasympathetic nervous system and calm everything down and sends those healthy safety signals to the brain that we're looking for. So that's another really good one too, that can be easy to use and super helpful, as well as using some of those diffusion techniques. So even if you can't get in with an ACT-informed therapist, you can practice that labeling of pausing when you're noticing those distressing thoughts coming on, and giving yourself that little reframe. Oh, I'm noticing that I'm having that thought again, that I can't do X, Y, or Z thing. Or maybe you repeat it in that silly voice, or you repeat it in that silly voice and then take a few minutes to hum, because humming can also really enhance that parasympathetic nervous system. So there's a lot of really easy, quick tools that can really, really help in those moments of distress. So that's definitely one thing that I wanted to get out there. I think too, just going back to some of those treatment modalities, especially with things like hypnosis, that we know is really effective, especially if somebody's looking for more short-term therapy. It's really uniquely powerful, especially in things like autoimmune conditions like spa, because it can simultaneously reduce pain perception and sensitivities in the gut or other places in the body. So those sensory anchors, like I mentioned, of, you know, placing the hand on the heart or imagining our favorite drink, really helps us reconnect with safety when stress builds up. So that's another really great one. Yeah.
I love that. And the diaphragmatic breathing, I think, is worth, like, you humming seems to, like, that diffuses immediately. I think it's like the vibration. Mm-hmm. Diaphragmatic breathing, I can remember being in some sort of physical therapy 20 years ago and saying to the physical therapist, like, this isn't working. And she's like, well, your diaphragm's been sticky for decades.
Right.
So it does take a little time, I would caution people. That's great. I love it. Did we miss anything else before we? wrap
up? Oh, gosh. I think probably one last important thing. I mean, there's a lot of important things, but one last thing is I think a big thing that often comes up is that, and I think you mentioned this earlier, maybe some individuals not fully understanding the benefits and the real need for mental health care in treating health conditions, is that a lot of times people, I think, believe that stress management is, as one, you know, vague maybe way to put it, is kind of optional or like softer care, as opposed to, you know, following up with, let's say, your rheumatologist and staying on top of your medication, which is also very important, of course, and something we could also work on in therapy as a quick aside if we need to. But many people think that maybe, you know, mental health doesn't have a real seat at the table, so to speak. But and I think that might also just come from, you know, like generational, you know, differences, or just years of like maybe conditioning or communication of like, I have to push through, ignore my symptoms, or just like wait it out until I see this doctor, until things feel a little better. So really reframing that, you know, mental health treatment is core medical care. And even if our country doesn't want to reflect that and like insurance and things like that, which is another discussion, right? But it's just as essential as meds and just as essential as physical therapy, you know, and so that's really, really important as well. And if anything, it's certainly not soft care. It can certainly take it can certainly be a little bit more work than maybe some other things that we might feel as though are, you know, harder care aspects of treatment, right? Another barrier is time. So, you know, circling back to what I had mentioned with some of those techniques, you know, finding small practices that we can integrate into our existing routines is amazing. And then one last thing I always say to patients is rest is productive, if not very helpful. So oftentimes I think we feel like we need to always be productive and go, 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 but rest is just productive as movement. So that's another thing I'd like to just leave here for everybody.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah.
You're like filling up my cup for...
These are all things I need to remind myself of too.
But it's true. And I think your point, like, right, there's healthcare barriers that exist. But there's also this element of like, we all expect everything to happen quickly and to have to take on all of the things that really nobody can do these, but like we have to give ourselves a break. I like that. Rest is productive, if not helpful. That is perfect. I'm going to land there. Antonia, thank you for joining us. And I really appreciate all that you've shared. And Are you only available in New Jersey, or are you available? Is there a place to find you if people are looking for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm licensed in multiple states. So I'm physically in New Jersey, but I am licensed in New Jersey, New York, Virginia. I have to pause and think sometimes because the list is growing. Florida, Montana. There's been a couple others recently. Massachusetts. And I'm almost, hopefully will be licensed fully in California soon, but I'm able to see patients as I'm getting to that or I'm engaging in the process of licensure. So they have some rules surrounding that, which makes it nice for those of us that aren't fully licensed yet, but are seeking licensure. So I can currently see patients in California as well. At GI Psych, amongst all of us clinicians, we cover all 50 states. So even if you're not located in any of the states I just named, somebody at our practice is. So certainly finding us at gipsychology.com, or on social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. I also am on Instagram as Dr. Antonia Repelet. So
amazing.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah.
Thank you. And yeah, look forward to speaking again soon and getting an update on something.
Yes, I hope so. Thank you so much.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.